You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, June 15th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, if not metaphorical, shadow, but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It's Casual Friday, folks. If you're looking on the Ustream, you can see that I have spent my time preparing, not primping today. On the program, the great Cliff Schechter, the great Isabel Gillies with our Friday movie reviews, and the wonderful and great Jeff Smith of Occupy Wall Street. Give us an update on those trials that are taking place today in New York City. But as we do on every Friday, before we go to Cliff Schechter, first, ladies and gentlemen, to talk about all the news, whether it's the Dream Act instituted via prosecutorial discretion, or the latest on the corporate takeover of our trade acts. First, we must hear the Cliff Schechter theme song.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, Cliff Schechter. Hello, Cliff.
Hello there, Sam. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing well, slowly recovering from Netroots Nation. We had a chance to sit down and talk, not as much as we had hoped, because I got caught up in the tide of social debauchery, I guess. Are you there?
It happens, man.
I see you're moving at a slower than normal pace as well.
Yeah, I just had, I must apologize. I just had someone, a libertarian, who you may be friendly with, too. He's a friend of mine, John Hankey. Do you know him?
Oh, yes, John Hankey.
And he is now tweeting out stuff, positive stuff about Mitch McConnell. And as somebody who worked an election cycle in Kentucky and knows the whole, I wrote a feature article for the Washington Monthly about 7 or 8 years ago on McConnell and what he does. He's now giving this speech like he's a First Amendment hero, which is all just a convenient ploy so that he can say that everybody should be able to raise as much corporate money as they want. So he does little things now and again to pretend that he's really for the First Amendment, like he was against the flag-burning amendment because that was a huge sacrifice. So knowing his whole story, I sent him into John, and he happened to hit me back right when you were talking there. So, yes, I will put down the computer, stop staring at it, and realize that John is can be engaged with later.
Oh, yeah, he'll
Sam,
be there.
I'm here to speak.
He will undoubtedly
be there
in
I
moments.
I actually like him as far as I'm not insulting him. As far as defenders of Mitch McConnell go, John would probably be my favorite guy. But I need to have a little conversation with him.
That's not necessarily a really high bar.
when it comes to. But,
that's a good point. Tough. You got to claw. You got to claw all the way past Ted Nugent and Victoria Jackson to get there.
Indeed. Well, Cliff, let me quote you to start off. You know, this is not, we always, every by Wednesday, I always have sort of like, well, maybe Cliff and I, we're going to have a different type of conversation, this week. But, if I can quote you, it was something to the effect of, damn the Republicans for making it so, making me vote so hard for Obama. Did I get that?
But along those lines, I'm not sure I used the word damn.
Well,
but
I
yeah.
know. Darn.
You like to go clean. You're not you're not the Lenny Bruce.
Darn.
Yes. That's right.
Well, I am, but just not on the on the first part of the show, which may be replaying in Washington, D.C.
That's a good point.
I'm trying to save you from a tremendous amount of FCC bills.
Well, that's good. I appreciate that. And people, you know, catch you late at night if you're not, let's say, doing all that well at the craps tables in Vegas.
Oh, indeed. Indeed.
I've heard the words that come out of your mouth.
Oh, yes. I like a sailor, like a pirate even. I usually do it with like a pirate accent when I cuss. What do you want to start with? You want to start with the horrible thing that Obama has done this week, or the positive thing that he has done this week?
What do you think? Do we end with a?
I think we should end on an up note. That's the way. Okay. That's what they taught us in Hollywood. You always want to end on an up note, so that people are leaving.
That's where the you being a show business maven.
Oh, absolutely, of course. So. Well, this Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, let's go back a little bit.
Is there anything like a transvaginal ultrasound, by the way?
I think for a lot of people on the receiving end of this, it may very well be.
well played, Sam.
Thank you. During the 2008 campaign, President Obama came out basically against NAFTA. And more or less said, you know, we're not going to do stuff like that. We're going to the constant refrain. We're going to try and institute those labor and environmental regulations that never got instituted back in the day. During the campaign, we saw there was a campaign document. We will not negotiate bilateral trade agreements that stop the government from protecting the environment, food safety, or the health of its citizens, give greater rights to foreign investors than to U.S. investors, require the privatization of our vital public services, or prevent developing country governments from adopting humanitarian licensing policies to improve access to life-saving medications. As far as I can tell, based upon this new memo that has been revealed, these documents that have been revealed on the website of Public Citizen, the Trans-Pacific Partnership does all that. Am I wrong?
It's sort of like if you list everything he said and do just in like a Bizarro episode, do just the opposite, you get there.
Yeah, it's like what my daughter says. Some morning she wakes up, she says, "Dad, you smell. It's opposite day." And this is it feels like it's opposite day today.
I mean, yeah, this the whole thing is so bad for so many reasons. Obviously, the biggest one being, let's separate them all out. First of all, the rank dishonesty behind the whole, we're going to renegotiate NAFTA and that whole sort of ploy when he was running in the primaries.
To be fair, we did get an indication. There were reports that Austin Goolsbee went up to Canada and said, hey, don't listen to anything he's saying about NAFTA.
That's a good point. I know he's just talking down there. But at the time, you know, we had like Mark Penn unilaterally trying to negotiate with the Colombian government for free trade for Hillary Clinton. So
right.
It wasn't a huge choice at that particular moment.
That's true.
But you're right. I mean, it's sort of like it was always that question during that campaign. You know, are we going to trust him and believe him? And I came to the conclusion that that he seemed better than the alternatives, and so I thought there was definite possibility for something awesome to happen, but I thankfully didn't rest all my hopes on it. because I'd be severely depressed, like I think a lot of people are, and I don't blame them for it. I mean, look, what do you say about this? First of all,
well, let's back up and before we sort of characterize the oppositeness in which the Obama administration has approached this, let's just talk about what it is. It's essentially a so-called free trade agreement that is being struck with 8 countries, Pacific countries across the Pacific, as it were.
With the possibility for others to join,
The possibility for others to join, that essentially sets up a mechanism whereby domestic corporations in this country cannot challenge labor regulations, environmental regulations, consumer safety regulations. However, foreign corporations, and I guess it's not hard to imagine that domestic corporations could set up foreign entities.
A foreign entity headquartered somewhere else.
That would then go to a supposed, it would be a Trans-Pacific Partnership court, as it were, that would then adjudicate whether or not the barriers, the environmental regulations or the consumer protections or the labor regulations in some way inhibited their business. And this court, of course, is not made up of labor or environmentalists. It's made up of corporate shills. Did I get that right? Have I left anything out?
The only part you've left out is the fact that this court can not only overturn U.S. law, essentially, but this court could also impose financial penalties upon us. There's a case given here where I read about in NAFTA already where some American investor, I can't remember his name, bought a plot of land in Mexico, and they declared that he had to clean it up because it was full of so many toxins. And he sued them and got a $15 million decision where the Mexican government had to pay him. So that's kind of the situation we're looking at here.
Yeah, essentially.
People can literally sue us. We'll have to pay off people to pollute our land and screw our workers and do various other things that are fine and upstanding of that sort.
Now, essentially it's, yes, we are paying for the right to protect our own citizens in many respects. And I'm not one of those people who are concerned about, the encroachment of our sovereignty from something like Agenda 21 from the United Nations.
But I would think that the good thing about this is I would think that Tea Party / Ron Paulite type folks would freak out over this.
Well, I mean, I think to a certain extent,
a meeting of 4 guys in a room, they're pretty much convinced that that means that a takeover is looming.
Yeah, so. Well, I mean, this could be one of those situations where the fact that it is so offensive to everyone in many respects. Now, of course, the Tea Partiers would want us not to have the ability to have regulations to protect our own citizenry or our own environment or our own workers. But be that as it may, we've got Senator Ron Wyden has introduced legislation requiring further disclosure on this stuff. Because, again, we got to say, this whole thing has been negotiated completely secretly.
That's right. I mean, I started off and meant to sort of list what was terrible about this. And I started off by saying the campaign, the fact that it was that he had lied to us really pretty bluntly. When you consider what is going on here, that was the first thing. But the second thing was that this is being done completely behind closed doors where Congress doesn't even know a lot of what's going on. You know, I mean, thirdly, I guess we would say this is unbelievably terrible politics. There's nobody that likes this, as I was saying. You'll get people on the right, the non-corporate right, that'll be just as angry about this as people on the left will be. So really it's a way of showing everybody is trying to play into the I'm a corporate elitist to everyone. It sort of loses on all scores. And of course, obviously there's just that everyday impact it will have on people, on workers and on the environment, which is terrible too. I mean, there's nothing good I can see in this. Maybe I'm missing the silver lining somewhere.
I'm trying to find the silver lining here, and so far the only silver lining I can find, well, there's two aspects of it. One is that at least somebody got a hold of this memo and leaked it. I guess presumably, you know, this is the campaign season, so somebody thought that they could get some benefit out of it. But fortunately, the memo is leaked, and during a campaign season, one would imagine there's going to be a lot of pushback on this. The second aspect of it is you know, we're seeing at least unions talk in a way that we haven't heard them talk before in many respects.
I was gonna say, quote some of that stuff if you have that salon piece, because I mean, the unions are already getting up in arms about this, and yeah, I would, thankfully they are, because I think they've often been too docile to the Obama administration, and wow, well, look at, I mean, I don't know if you want to read the quote.
Joseph Nigro, president of the International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers, said over email, this is again Josh Idelson reporting at Salon, said over email that the leak showed that this, quote, this administration would seek to extend the worst parts of horrible agreements like NAFTA. He said that these leaks offered an example why his union will only support and work for those candidates and parties that serve to support working people. Chris Townsend, the PAC director for the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America, said this is what happens when you get an administration that's pretty much in the lap of corporate America. You have...
that's who they perform for. That's who most of them will go to work for after they lose the election in November.
Yeah.
Wow. That's the end of his quote. I mean, that's just... When you hear them talking like that, you've probably crossed a line somewhere.
And Tucker, who is the let me pull this out here. In talking about the NAFTA and talking about this trade agreement in particular, Todd Tucker, who's a research director at Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. These are the this is a group, I think, that found this memo and posted it. Said this is exactly the same template that was used in NAFTA and other agreements that President Obama campaigned against. And he said that the most sort of depressing part of that is that this is not like past trade agreements that have been ratified in the past, because this one was actually developed rather than simply passed under Obama, that the Obama administration literally generated this entire plan. So this is pretty ugly stuff. And hopefully...
Well, it gives credence to, you know, there are people on the left who are just, you know, who there are some who say they won't vote for Obama. There are plenty or you know, go back and forth and are hugely angry. You know, and this gives credence to what they say sometimes. I mean, I've made the argument before that I don't think it has to be mutually exclusive, that you're either tyrannical and weak. You can kind of be both at times. You know, there could be a little bit of one, a little bit of the other. I think that this goes to the side of people who, you know, is like a point to people who say that this isn't about that Obama's weak. This is that he's getting exactly what he wants and making people think that he's weak, because this is just that terrible. And again, I would still argue with that view, just because, and not argue completely. I think there's some of that. Like, the grand bargain is obviously something he wants, even mentioned in his speech yesterday.
Indeed. Supposed
to be so populist. But there are other things like a bigger stimulus and some other things like that, obviously, that he does, that I think he wanted, and yet he just wouldn't fight for them. So I think, sadly, it's I come to the same analysis myself that I did in the past. It's a combo of both.
Yeah, I think it's a combo of both, but I also think the perception of the relative importance of different issues also plays into that. You know, because simultaneously, as this comes out, the Obama administration is going to announce, and I think President Obama himself is speaking probably in about an hour, it's 12:20 here, East Coast time on Friday, is going to be speaking in about an hour. He's going to announce a new immigration policy that is essentially an executive decision via sort of prosecutorial discretion through the Department of Homeland Security instituting the DREAM Act.
Right, which, you know, is terrific, and that I will give him full credit for. I think I wouldn't be honest if I didn't say I don't know why he didn't do it sooner. It was kind of like on some of the gay rights issues where it took so long, and you sort of said to yourself, who is it that you're courting here, you know, by not doing this? You know, it, sadly, as much as I hate the corporate stuff, I get why he does that. You know what I mean? I mean, he wants the campaign contributions. I don't get why, when it comes to the socially regressive, you know, more Christian coalition, more right-wing, socially, you know, paleo-conservative, almost Pat Buchanan types, why he has ever not been completely forward on issues that they care about that will piss them off, because what does he need them for? You know, I mean, that I've never really gotten.
I mean, I think that, look, there is it's obviously would have been better to pass the DREAM Act as legislation. But essentially what's going to happen today is that Janet Napolitano is announced this morning. And I think, like I say, President Obama is going to speak about it this afternoon, that effectively immediately, and this is a release from I'm reading from a press release here, that effectively immediately certain young people who were brought to the United States as young children, and remember, this is basically what the DREAM Act was. If you were a child of undocumented immigrants and they brought you here, obviously you don't have much of a choice. And if they meet certain criteria, they will not be deported. If you came to the United States under the age of 16, if you have continuously resided in the United States for at least 5 years, preceding the date of today, June 15th, I guess, if you are currently in school or have graduated from high school, or have obtained a General Education Development Certificate, the GED, or are honorably discharged veterans of the Coast Guard or Armed Forces of the United States and have not been convicted of a felony, and you're not above the age of 30, you will have 2 years of essentially being able to stay in this country, deferred action on any type of deportation, and it will be subject to renewal, and you'll be eligible to apply for work authorization.
I want you to read all those requirements again really quickly.
16.
Just having some.
In the United States, 5 years.
So many things there.
Well,
like
I mean, yeah, there's a lot of,
while
yeah,
staring at the moon, while drinking soda.
Right. I mean, but that is the point. That's, I mean, the fact that there are so many bars to this that you must cross over shows just how sort of reasonable this is. I mean, we're talking about young people who are brought here, who have grown up as Americans, perceive themselves as Americans, have and have shown that they perceive themselves as members of the society by their actions and behavior, and that they're also beyond that, not just members of our society, but productive members of our society. It seems like a completely a slam dunk. Now, of course, the right wing is going to use this as some type of cudgel. But again, you make a very good point. Every time the right wing brings this up, they're going to be helping President Obama. And this is coming in the wake of some reporting. I don't know how legitimate it is, but I imagine there are polls out there that the Obama campaign has seen, or are they getting messages from their constituents in particularly in the Latino community saying, mm-hmm. you know, we backed you in 08 and you have not been able to accomplish the reforms that you claim are so important to you. And we need to see some type of activity here.
Yeah, I mean that's the whole thing, is that, you know, and this is part of that trifecta of plans that were created by Republicans. Remember, this was originally the Republican idea for how we should reform immigration. you know, which is create responsibility, have people say that you have to get an education or have to serve in the military. You know, I mean, this is up there with cap and trade and the mandate, the healthcare mandate, as I look at it, as the trifecta of things that were all created by a Republican Party of 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, somewhere along that line, back when they used to actually believe in trying to solve problems, as opposed to just saying, okay, now you guys are for that, so we're going to move 5 steps further to the right and call you socialists for being for what we were once for.
Right.
Which is essentially how you're going to see this thing play out now. Or there's my favorite reaction so far that I've seen on Twitter by basic right-wing jackwad Jay Severin. You remember that guy?
Yeah, who is that guy?
He's sort of a radio host.
Oh,
TV
Jay
guy.
Severin, right. Boston, out of Boston, right? You got.
Yeah, when Tucker Carlson had his crappy TV show on MSNBC that nobody watched, so they fired him. Jay Severin used to be the guy that would go on and argue, I think, against Rachel Maddow, because they'd be the two kind of guest panelists that would go on, and Severin would come on and say stupid things to the point where they eventually let him go from a show that wasn't even doing very well. He tweeted out that in response to this, the response on the right should be to impeach Obama, which I retweeted and, of course, added. That's a very novel concept from the right.
Right.
I'm always glad when they come up with a new way to solve our problems, because I don't remember I've ever heard that one before.
I mean, it is stunning to see the things that they react to. Now, of course, we see this type of prosecutorial discretion all the time in the context of the bankers, just not in a way that we want to see it. You know, there is no way, it's not possible for the Department of Homeland Security and ICE, the Immigration Authority, to deport all of the undocumented immigrants. And so, of course, this is simply making a prosecutorial priorities, essentially, and making an administrative executive decision. Would it be better?
There's a ton of power that resides there.
Right.
That they can, I mean, look at what Bush did constantly, you know, and that is where many of us have been frustrated with Obama, like you and I at past times, which is, you know, there are plenty of ways by who you put at the head of your cabinet and a gazillion sub-cabinet positions, which may be even more important, just like who you choose to put on as federal judges, you know, not just the Supreme Court, but the ones that people never hear about until there's a big case in front of them, to who you choose to run smaller regulatory agencies. I mean, there's just a lot of discretion and power on the, you know, that you can have. And Rick Perlstein wrote a great piece. I don't know if you read Rick's stuff over at Rolling Stone this past week, pointing out how the woman that slapped Tom Barrett in the face. Did you see that whole thing in Wisconsin?
Yeah.
How he went up to her and basically asked her for a hug, and she slapped him in the face because he conceded while votes were still being counted, and how that whole thing was a metaphor for the Democratic Party and why it loses. That we're always hugging people, and we're never fighting the Republicans. We're busy conceding while votes are still being counted. Something about the year 2000 seems to come to mind. And, you know, that's what this whole thing reminds me of, is finally Obama's doing this, and congrats to him, and it's great that he's doing it, but it's sort of like the right never even thinks twice about doing things like this. They just do it.
Indeed.
It's not even a big deal.
And we should also make a point. David Dayen tweeted out something to the effect of the last time the administration made a statement like this with deportation reviews. A year later, it turned out only 2% of all deportations were spared. And so he makes the point, trust but verify. And
he's 100% right on that. I mean, look, we've all been there before on issues we care about or all sorts of issues. I remember working on the gun issue, how the nation was going to have a conversation after Tucson. And Obama was going to wait a little bit, but then was going to speak up on this issue. By the way, another issue that, you know, the coalition he's trying to put together would only play well with that coalition, with the NRA also already calling him basically a space alien and saying he needs to lose. Again, when it comes to these types of issues, the economic issues, don't think I'm giving him a free pass. All I'm saying is, from a cynical political perspective, I get why he does stuff like that, because I get where that's coming from. But I just don't understand, when you're trying to put together a coalition like you had in 2008 of young, multi-ethnic, you know, forward-thinking, often urban, suburban, you know, and that kind of thing, anything that makes single women, you know, the Hispanic population, the gay population, and most others happy with you, you should support.
Just from a demographic, from a sheer, like you say, from a sheer cynical demographic perspective.
Right. I mean, that's what's going to win you Colorado and Nevada and perhaps Florida. You know, that's what's, I mean, that kind of stuff. I mean, in the end, that's you know, when it comes to what he did today or is doing today.
Yeah,
go ahead. Sorry.
Well, and I would add in Florida, the other thing is going to be when they start going around talking about the Ryan plan and Romney's embrace of it in terms of Medicare. But of course, like you mentioned, just yesterday during his speech from Cleveland, which was ostensibly supposed to be to draw the distinctions between Romney and Obama, which I think he did fairly well. But
overall, yes.
Overall, but he still sort of bemoaned the lack of a grand bargain, putting it out there, because I think he's still determined to get one, and hopefully he won't. Hopefully we can count on the...
Wouldn't it have been amazing if in that speech where he's differentiating himself and pointing out not wanting to go back to Republican economics and going back to what failed before, if he'd said, you know, when he's differentiating himself, I'm for this, they're for that, if he'd said, they're for the Paul Ryan plan to decimate us and turn us back to where we were during the Great Depression or before that, you know, I'm for Social Security with 80% of the American people, you know, with the greatest anti-poverty program ever, the biggest social insurance program for children. And it's a value that I will not negotiate. I will not, you know, the way, I mean, people attack Bill Clinton. That's what Bill Clinton said about Medicare, you know, and that helped him win re-election in 96.
Yeah, rather striking. And I don't know what would be more stunning, if President Obama said this or the fact that it's actually such a pipe dream that he would come out and say, I will not. I will veto anything that calls for cuts in Social Security, cost of living increases. I will veto anything that raises the retirement age. I will veto anything that in any way tries to mess with Social Security, other than an increase in revenues by lifting the cap to capture the same amount of income as it did in 1983.
It would be that simple. I mean, they say often there's nuance in Democrats. It's tougher to have a message because we're not people who are black and white like the other side, and that's true. But here's one that's just that simple: raise the cap to where it was in 1983. Done. Then we won't have a non-crisis in 30 years from now.
And it's so stunning that we are talking about that in terms of like he'll never say that.
That's what's so frustrating. And again, that would all, when we're talking about demographically, yeah, he's going to get crushed among old, you know, probably middle aged to older white males. But this is one of the few areas, particularly with Mitt Romney's attacks on firemen and policemen and some of those white males. This would be the kind of thing that in a state like the one I'm in here, I talked about what Hispanic, you know, being for the Dream Act and other things would do in Colorado and Nevada. Well, what it would do to stand up in favor of Social Security and in favor of pensions and things like that in an older, whiter state like Ohio, what it would do in other older, whiter states like Iowa. I mean, you know, that he wants to win in the Midwest. I don't know if he necessarily has to win, but certainly would be helpful. I mean, it's such a simple map to sit down and map out who you're trying to appeal to and how to do it. And the polling tells you how easy it is. As I've said before, when an Amerist poll, I think it was an Amerist poll, 76% of teabaggers are saying they don't want their Social Security touched. You can pretty much guess that's a winning issue.
When I cite this many times, but when I was down at that Glenn Beck rally, the 828 rally in 2010, and I heard just all sorts of insanity from these people. I mean, ranging from, you know, there's not enough God in our government to we should have a law where no bill is longer than 10 pages long to, you know, there's a secret Muslim training ground in upstate New York. We need to deal with these things.
Right.
The one thing I heard over and over again, and I would say, I mean, to be fair, out of the 40 or 50 people I interviewed, I think two were on board with cutting Medicare or Social Security. The rest, when explicitly asked, said, well, no, I wouldn't cut that because that already exists. Even though...
All you need to know is Ayn Rand took her Medicare.
Yeah, exactly. Even though, you know, Medicare is basically puts about 50 million Americans on socialized health insurance. And Social Security is a socialistic program. And I did have one or two guys who said, yes, that is socialistic. I would cut the whole thing. This country has been a socialist country since the 1930s. And let me just say this to you, the Second Amendment. And I'm not going to say anymore, but I'm prepared. I'm not going to tell you how I'm prepared because I can't give that away. And, you know, every other nutso thing that I heard there, none of them wanted their Medicare or Social Security cut. No. And just because it's already there. It's already there.
And again, I know some of the corporate guys, you know, that may be affecting him on this too. But in the end, there are a lot of corporate guys that are for Social Security and Medicare. It's not an issue that there's a few billionaires out there and people on the right and the centristy center who want to go after this thing. But this isn't like, the people on the left who are wealthier are clamoring for this. We do have that problem in a few other areas when it comes to education and some other places. But I don't get this stuff.
All right, let's.
I want to get it, Sam, but I don't.
Let's talk briefly about Netroots Nation. I have not followed the controversy apparently that Darcy Berner ignited, but it is one. You know, we're seeing this across the country. You know, and I love I've seen quite a bit of mockery of the notion of the war on women. In the corporate media, certainly by the right, but make no mistake, people should understand that we are in fact seeing a war on women. Yes, it's a slogan, but the fact is we're seeing an unprecedented attack on women's rights, and you know whether it's in Michigan, their capacity to say the word vagina. Apparently, which has now been outlawed in certain quarters. But tell us what happened with Darcy Berner at
the vagina controversy in Michigan. Just I'll say quickly shows how juvenile these people are. They want to ban things probably because they still haven't actually reached emotional puberty.
Well, so I mean, look, it's not inconsistent.
It's a bad word.
We saw in Virginia, in North Carolina, where they're banning terms like sea level rising. Or banning things like sustainable living, you know, I mean, pretty soon.
Arizona was moving on that bill. I think they passed it in the Oklahoma State Senate did, and somehow was blocked in the House. They wanted to actually not allow you to teach alternative energy and global warming in schools.
We've seen legislation, don't say gay in the schools. We have seen we saw this with the financial crisis committee, where the Republicans, you know, struck the words Wall Street and corruption and theft from their sort of, I guess, minority report.
Were there any actual words left when you took those out?
Well, exactly. That's just the point.
I think there are a couple of the's.
A and the, but nothing over three letters. Tell us who Darcy Berner is. Tell us what happened at Netroots Nation for people who don't know.
Right. So Darcy Berner, people may remember, she ran twice before, came very close to winning a congressional seat in a very swing, slightly lean Republican seat out in the Seattle area. There's a new district created with the redistricting, the first congressional district. The Democratic nominee will likely win in that district. And so she's running, she's as progressive as progressive. I mean, she's the person that we all wish was running for every seat in the Senate and the House. And she's fearless too. She stands up and says what she believes, which is a refreshing thing too. So she was speaking, talking during a keynote at Netroots Nation, where Elizabeth Warren was also there. Who was the other one from Hawaii, whose name I can't think of. In any case, Darcy stood up and gave her speech. And at one point, she said she talked about women gaining power and whatever, and talked about the power of the closet, keeping things in the closet. And how when people got to know someone who is gay, it's amazing how you become much more in favor of gay rights. And so she pointed out the fact that statistically, up to the age of 45, one in three women in this country will have had an abortion. And it's something that we push into the shadows and we shame women, slut shame them and the rest. And so she asked if women were willing to, in the audience, to stand up if they'd had an abortion, would they do so? And only if they felt comfortable with it. And women did. And then she asked the other women if they would stand up with them and the fact that they had made these choices. And the other women did. And then some people clapped. A lot of people in there clapped for the fact that women were willing to stand up for the rights of other women. And that was that. And then Darcy said, well, what I think is a very important point, which is this is how we change the stories in people's heads, which is, of course, that's exactly what happens when you take things out of the closet. People find out they're much more common and much more regular than you would think. The response, of course, predictably on the right, that one of these Breitbartians, Melissa Cloutier, whatever her name is, accused the crowd of cheering for abortion, saying it was objectively a wonderful thing. She misquoted, my guess is purposely, what Darcy said, and attacked Darcy as, of course, being a, you know, an abortion lover and that kind of thing. And then Tucker, you know, Swanson, McNear, Carlson site picked up on it, because, of course, that's what Tucker Carlson does these days. And then it led to some people that are in the mainstream media, Seattle Post Intelligence, are picking it up from these right-wing bloggers, and where that's how the whole game works, right? And saying that, that's what Darcy was doing. And, of course, anybody with a few firing neurons who was there knew that that's not what she was doing. Any more than you know, all what she was doing is saying that we stand with women who have made this decision, and it's a perfectly legal and legitimate decision. Not saying, yeah, abortion, but saying, you made this decision. You shouldn't be pushed into the shadows. And you are representative of a lot more people out there than those who are the moral police want to pretend. And I think it was a powerful moment. And what Darcy said was exactly right. What she did was right. And the fact is we need a lot more like her.
Yeah, she deserves plaudits for that, I guess, or applause, I should say, for that. It would be interesting to head down to that right con convention or whatever it is, the one that used to try and follow Netroots Nation around because they can't get press on their own. Apparently, they're meeting in Vegas. It would be interesting to sort of get into a room and ask them to stand up. Because we know, that is really the point, right? I mean, we know there are people at that convention who have gotten abortion, who have been involved with someone that has an abortion, who have family members that have had an abortion. And of course, they would never.
Have you asked all of them in that room to stand who had a connection to abortion or had a family member who was gay or secretly gay themselves or some other group that the right likes to attack pretty regularly, you'd probably have like 80% of that room.
Indeed. Well, good for Darcy Berner. And so if you ever have an opportunity, folks, to in any way show her some support, make sure you do so. I don't know if you'd do that via her website or on Twitter.
Yeah, I would guess you could do it on our website. I don't work for the campaign, but I guess that would be one way, Twitter, Facebook, any way. I think you show your support, and I think even more important, you know, very important to show it for Darcy, because if you don't get people's backs who come out and fight strong for our issues, then don't expect them to do so. And secondly, the concept that she was discussing. You know, I'll say quickly, I just wrote my weekly column on it this week, you know, about the conservative love for the closet, because it's like everything else. It's abortion and gay rights, sure, but it's also the truth about Social Security and who's in favor, because if they can keep in the closet the fact that 70% plus 80% don't want it cut, then maybe some people will think that they're speaking the truth and we all really do want it cut.
Indeed.
That's the way they succeed the best. You know, we don't all want, the majority of us don't want to raise taxes on the top 1%. The majority of us don't think this trade deal is insane and things like that. If they can keep stuff like that in the closet, they can get away with all sorts of things. And that's why it's important for people to know, for information to be out there and the truth to be out there. So,
the always wise Cliff Schechter. And we now have a link up on our site to a story that will point you towards a place where you can support Darcy Berner. Cliff, as always, a pleasure to speak to you.
Always a pleasure, although I have to slightly argue at the end, the always wise.
Often wise.
During the week.
Often
just for
wise.
This hour, half
sometimes
hour,
wise.
Have to exercise the whole week to get here.
Often so wise, sometimes wise. Wise enough for us, Cliff Schechter.
That's what I like. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks,
always
Cliff.
Good to be here, buddy.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Isabel Gillies. She will give us a movie review for the week. And then after that, we will talk to Jeff Smith to get an update on what's going on with the trials that have been ongoing for the past couple of days in New York City against some Occupy Wall Street protesters. We'll be right back after this.
Republicans' healthcare plan for America. Don't get sick.
If you think that's a fair ad, okay, then you're a Republican and an asshole. Have at it, Hoss. Be in that party. Despicable, man.
They're the bad guys.
Endless taxpayer bailout.
Yeah, that's not true.
When Obama won, the reason why we worked so hard for him,
we didn't want a garden variety politician.
Taking a stand, not just cutting deals.
That's what vision is. Yeah. That's what vision is.
The Best of the Left podcast. The best of the truly liberal media. Edited, organized, and mixed. Only at bestoftheleft.com.
Today is Casual Friday. Let us welcome Isabel Gillies to the show. She's going to recommend a movie or two to watch on Netflix. It's the only way I know.
Listen to the picks from Isabel.
IsabelGillies.com.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen. I should say right off the bat that I got an email from Matthew Film Guy, who was like, what's up? Why are you skipping me? And I didn't realize that. I got so confused with all the traveling and all the Dave Hill stuff. I may be out of order, but Isabel Gillies stepped in. We'll get to Matthew Film Guy next week, so all apologies. I didn't mean to, but it's always a pleasure to talk to Isabel. Hello, Isabel.
Hello, Sam.
How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm all fired up today.
Really? You sound it. Why?
Yeah, I am.
Why?
Well, man, I feel bad about Matthew, A.
Right.
That takes me down one notch, but sorry, Matthew.
It's not your fault. It's not your fault.
No, I know. Well, okay, so...
Can't go around carrying the world's burdens on your shoulders, Isabel.
This is what my power shrink said to me.
Your what?
Honestly, yeah, yeah.
No, you want to say that again? A power shrink?
Yeah, I go to a power shrink once every... 3 months.
A power shrink.
And, yeah, all the shrinks in my whole life have been these sort of middle-aged, Jewish, wonderful, sort of marvelous women who talk about my mother and my growing up and all that stuff, very gently sort of hand-holding, that kind of thing. And this dude's like, no, he's just a cognitive, say-it-like-it-is sort of Judd Hirsch, power shrink.
So you've just basically gone from Jewish, middle-aged Jewish women to sort of slightly older Jewish men.
No, Venezuelan men my own age.
Really? And so this guy basically just says, Isabel, stop it. You're with an accent. He says, stop it. You're acting like a child.
With a heavy accent. Yes. Yes, you're a drama queen.
Well,
that's your problem.
You know,
I know.
How much are you paying him for that? Because
I think
I've said that to you once or twice before, and so I think we could be. I think I could send you a bill.
I know. Well, he's a superpower shrink and tells me like it is, and
it's almost like an S&M type of thing. Like you go in and he tells you you're a drama queen. Get out of here.
No. Then he says that, and I flopped over and started sodding on the sofa.
And then did he
like,
go?
See?
Proof.
Point taken.
Proof.
Yes, he did. He was like, "See, look at you." And I was like, "Oh my god!"
Wait. So what were you being?
So
dramatic?
Why did we even? Why were we talking about?
Because you can't say to me, "I just got back from my power shrink," and not have me say, "What?"
No, I know, but what got me on it?
Because I don't know, you were about to say you were feeling so up today, and then you said, but I'm down. A
because no, because then you said that don't have the whole weight of the world on your on your shoulder.
Okay,
right. So how that got to that is that so you know I wrote the article about Brazil, which I believe comes out today.
Okay, so people can check that out in where? What?
At Vogue. I don't know. Newsstands.
Okay,
but
can't get Vogue.
Lower your expectations. No, we've talked about this. I don't think there is any perfume. So get it online, maybe.
All right.
But let me tell you, just lower your expectations a little bit about the article.
Well,
I think the pictures are going
to be. I got to be honest with you. I'm not in a position to go to any type of spa, never mind in Brazil or anywhere. So, my expectations.
I know. I'm just talking about the writing, but here's why. So the first day that I was in Brazil, it rained, like really rained, and I cried. And my husband was like, okay, but what's your problem? Because I couldn't stop crying. I was like, well, if I'm writing an article, I'm not about a beautiful tropical place and it's rainy, I'm not going to be able to see the color of the water, the sky, it's all going to be ruined. And I just couldn't stop crying. I couldn't stop crying until through breakfast. The weather reports that it was going to be 4 days of rain, and I was crying. And that seemed problematic to my husband, to me. It eventually turned sunny for the whole time. But the point was I went back to New York, went to the power shrink, and he said, so what made you cry like that? And I said, well, because, the town, it was about this hotel, and the town is really depending on the success of this hotel, for jobs and for the town to be successful and for their economy. And he went, whoa. You think that the economy of the town is resting on your article in Vogue magazine? And I was like, okay, you're right. Which goes to the point. See? Get it? Narcissist.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you something. Somebody deserves a medal on Father's Day. I can tell you that right now. You're going to be handing out a lot of medals.
He's not my father.
Well, I know, but he's somebody's father. I mean, you should be getting... it's arguable what's
husband
going on.
Husband Day, maybe.
Huh?
Husband Day.
Yeah. Somebody needs a medal for that. So, all right. Well, so right. Everybody should go read this Vogue article so that the economy of Brazil does not collapse.
Exactly. Oh. Okay. Anyway. So you know I take this job seriously about picking the movies.
No,
and
I
here
know
it
you
is.
Do. That's,
I do. And here it is the
I
end of
say
school.
Most of the people who do it, but go ahead.
Right. Well, and rightly so. So here's the end of school, and at our school we had this kind of cool thing, which was this ballroom dancing.
Yeah, now I didn't do this. I didn't see this. I think my daughter is too young for that. But we did have outdoor huge. You know, before we get to that ballroom dancing thing, I should say that yesterday, both our children were involved in an outdoor sort of dance thing, right?
Festival.
With their grades, they were the entire grade. I think K
of 150 children, and in the case of the third grade, 180.
Right, in a big in the big yard, they call it. And the only thing I could think when I was watching them dance, and after they had played the Star Spangled Banner, was that was that documentary you recommended on those Korean games.
Oh, what an interesting connection.
Well, it's just like a bunch of kids going around in unison. Now, of course, in Korea, they're much better than these kids.
And much better, and it's for the great one.
Right, it's for the great one. But even still, I found it all...
Not Mrs. Wilmer.
I saw just a slight... exactly, I saw a slight...
Did you watch that movie, Sam?
Yeah, I did. Of course.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I had tears streaming down my face and was videotaping the whole thing and was making no connections except just the joy of...
You were crying. You were crying during that. Yeah,
oh,
I know.
Yeah.
I mean, that is... You got the... It's not hard. That's not a big bar, is it? I mean...
No. But then, so in the fourth grade, they do this thing called ballroom dancing, and a group comes in, and they started in the Bronx, and they're in 200 schools now, and they teach children sort of, I think, 7 or 9 bar, real merengue, tango, the swing, real dances, and they have proper etiquette, and the kids are respectful of each other, and 150 children doing these dances. It was the most moving thing. People were on their feet screaming, crying, and there is a documentary called Mad Hot Ballroom. But everyone, don't get your hopes up just for a second, because so it's about this documentary about this very thing. So I was like, perfect, I'm going to do it for the Majority Report, and it's going to be great. And I went and watched the trailer, and I was getting all jazzed up to watch it. I cried during the trailer, I'll have you know.
How long is the trailer?
The trailer is, you know, a minute. Okay, so
how long did it take you to cry?
Watch it.
I'm just curious.
Oh, like, I could cry in seconds.
I know. How many times have you cried after doing this segment?
How many times will I cry after?
How many times have you?
After this, have I cried in the future?
No, I'm saying, like, you've done this this movie segment multiple times on this program.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
curious, how many times afterwards have you cried? Just because.
No, never. I feel elated.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes tears of joy.
All right.
I already cried today.
I know, I don't.
Tell you that.
Of course, it's already past noon.
Right. So I go to find it to get all psyched and cozy up with my computer and watch it. And guess what? Oh, it's not on. It's not on Netflix.
What happened? Where was
it? Not for instant queue. Not for instant queue. It's not.
Oh, my God. So this is all.
I know.
This whole buildup has just been basically about making an excuse.
It continues.
What?
It continues. So then I was like, okay. I've got to be flexible. I've got to move on. It's still school year's ended. I think we should still go with the school theme. So I went on to the movie Spellbound, which is a really good movie about spelling bees that I happen to remember from a couple years ago. It's really, really good. Get all psyched for that. Oh, what's hot? Oh, it's not in the instant queue.
I saw that.
Yeah, well, it's a good one.
I had seen it before. It's what's his face? Who's the director of that? I can't remember, but I think I know his brother.
Wait a minute. Okay, so if there's filmmaker brothers, that could only be.
So wait a second. So then what happened?
So then I went and saw another movie called. What did you just say about women? The war against, it called The War Against Children. And that was about public school. So I was like, all right, I'll check that out. And that was about the no tolerance rule. It's called War Against Children, about the no tolerance rule in America.
What is the no tolerance rule?
No tolerance of violence or weapons or anything, but the Republican cuckoo birds have gone too far. And if a kid does a spitball at somebody else, they're arrested.
Nice.
So that was depressing. So I was like, forget that. So then, this is such a wandering, meandering movie review, but then I happened to see an ad for something called My Dog, which I clicked on. It's all about celebrities talking about their adopted dogs, like Edward Albee and E. Falco and Livingston, Taylor, John James Taylor's brother.
Wow, they really ran out of celebrities quick, didn't they?
Let me tell you about their dogs. At Glenn Close, Lynn Redgrave. So I start watching that just a quick check it out, knowing that you probably wouldn't be interested. And then, of course, I got caught into it, sobbed the whole time about the dogs. I'm now hell-bent on adopting a dog, to my husband's horror. And that was that. And now I'm running out of time. So now I was like, all right, screw it. You know what? Sometimes maybe you have to get out. You have to get out of your house. And you have to get out, and it doesn't matter if sometimes you have to make arrangements to have, you know, your kid hang out at a friend's house, even if it's in the morning. Maybe, you know, early in the morning you could go to a movie because it's half price. And so I went to Rock of Ages this morning, and that is why I'm all fired up.
What is Rock of Ages? I feel like you're having sort of a breakdown here.
I'm not, Sam. I'm not. I spent 2 hours in the 80s with Shadows of the Night. And, you know, it's Tom Cruise, Alec Baldwin. It's in the movie theater. Came out today. Rock of Ages.
I can't go to the movie theater.
But you say that. But can I just say why? Why?
Because
why
of my family.
You?
Because of my family. They won't let me. I mean, the last social thing I went to, the last sort of time I was allowed to leave the house for an unrelated work, not related to work. Excursion was just to go to Barnes & Noble to see Chris Hayes give his talk, and the only way I could justify that was because I pretended it was a work necessity.
Work-related?
Yeah.
Well,
and even then, I had to bring
it
back, I had to get a book for Mila. I had to get Chris Hayes to sign a book for my daughter.
You're
you don't understand what goes
girl.
On in my home. You don't understand.
I don't, because I went at 9:40. I dropped the kids off at school, and I went for $7. And listen, it's not the best movie in the world, but we're kids of the 80s. And hearing Mary J. Blige rock it to all those songs, it was just enjoyable to me.
I didn't listen to any of those songs in the 80s.
Bullshit.
No, I didn't.
You did.
I didn't. No. Nope.
You were not
Velvet
a metalhead
Underground.
At all?
In the 80s, I was listening to Velvet Underground. And then by 83, or I think it was, I was listening to The Replacements and Green on Red.
What?
And the Liars and all that stuff.
You weren't into glam rock or anything?
No. Missed it.
What?
Missed it. I missed it.
Oh. Well, did you avoid it or did you just miss it?
I don't know.
I wasn't conscious of
what was going on. I just ran into the Velvet Underground, and then everything sort of led from there.
Well, what about Pat Benatar, and what about, you know, your local radio station? Did you not listen to the radio?
I listened when I was a kid. The local radio station was WAAF in Worcester. But I got up on my roof and strung a wire so I could listen to WBUR, I think, which was the Brown station, or BRU, or whatever it was.
BRU, I remember.
Yeah,
Brown,
and that's what
station.
I basically listened to when I was, you know, around
13
or 14.
Oh, so you're so much way cooler than me.
I don't know what happened to that. I seem to have lost that entire cachet. I was like, my coolness
reversed.
Was dunked in amber and left somewhere in like 1993.
Right, when maybe mine was coming up.
Yeah.
Because I was right there with Pat Benatar.
Mm.
I was, you know, Shadows of the Night is one of my favorite songs. We're running with the shadows of the night.
Well, Isabel, so I guess this week we had sort of a little bit of a not a successful movie review,
well,
but that's all right,
because the ones in the past have been great,
and I'm not going to, you know.
Because you can watch Waiting for Superman is what I was getting to.
Oh, don't even start with
well,
that piece of horrible propaganda.
Discussion.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think that everything that Waiting for Superman endorses, the whole corporatization of a way of measuring schools, that mm-hmm. all the tremendous amount of testing, you know, you got two kids. The amount in which that school that we go to, that public school, is upended to take the tests. And I don't even think that school in particular has as much pressure as other schools around the city to teach to the test, to have the test there so they can get funding, so that they can make sure that there's some type of existence of the school. You're not going to see those ballroom dancing programs in the future because everything is going to be focused on this test because the stakes of this test are so high in terms of dictating a kid's future and dictating the future of the school. Everybody is incentivized to take these tests and to cheat on these tests and to teach towards these tests. It's ridiculous. And that's
well, and let me tell you another thing, because I just had a fourth grader that went through the tests, and just don't even get me started on these tests. They don't learn anything of substance. They don't. How about Dickens, guys? How about any? Everything they're learning is on the little sheet of paper. There's one sheet of paper that is about a topic like the Revolutionary War, and one, you know, maybe 150
words. Well, that
whole
it's Davis Guggenheim who did that movie, right?
Yes.
Waiting for Superman. I think it's David. That movie. Just full-on propaganda. And you can watch the same movie, and it's just called The Lottery, which is also full-on propaganda.
Right,
You know,
right.
And look, I appreciate the...
But it doesn't have... They're not talking about the tests, though, in Waiting for Superman.
Right.
They should do a whole nother documentary called The Test. And whoever came up with those tests... Oh, by the way...
You know why they won't? Because it's the same people who are pushing their agenda, this anti-teacher union agenda. I mean, look...
It's all the...
There's a couple. There are some good charter schools. There are also some good public schools. But on balance, charter schools do not educate children any better than public schools. If anything, there's data to support the fact that on balance, charter schools fail more often. Now they should, because they're set up as experiments. But of course, that was all bastardized. They were supposed to be set up as experiments so that ideas could be transported from there into the public school system. But it doesn't happen. Unfortunately, they're just stealing resources.
It shuts them down. It shuts public schools down.
Indeed.
And takes up the space for another public school to open in areas where it's needed.
Exactly. We got one of those in our district, don't we?
We sure do. And let me tell you about one thing about the test this year.
What?
They made it 70 minutes long. 70 minutes for...
third graders.
8-year-olds and 9-year-olds and 10-year-olds have to sit for 70 minutes because they've added diagnostic questions to the test that don't count. So my little kid, who has attention problems anyway, and dyslexia, has to sit there and concentrate so hard because he knows, because his teachers are putting pressure on him, I'm putting pressure on him, because that's the only way he gets into middle school, by the way,
or
the tests. He's putting pressure on himself, and all of that attention, all of that focus, and all that pressure could be going to a question that doesn't count. That's so that they can get information for the next year's test. Whoever made that decision, I want to go and sit there and make them do that test over and over and over again all day long.
Well, that's not, I mean, I thought you were going to say something like rip
that's
their
what
face
I went
off
to.
Or something, but you just basically...
I almost did, but remember, I'm on
that
temper thing.
I'm going to sit in their office and try and distract them from the work they're going to do that day.
Listen, those crazy tests, I read the questions. One was about
interbreeding. Yeah, the pineapple.
There was the pineapple, and then there was the interbreeding of large mammals like leopards and tigers. So there's the tiglip.
Wait a second. I want to get back to the movie. Will you go back and watch that movie and watch it with a slightly jaundiced and skeptical eye? Instead of getting caught up in the emotional experience.
Yes. Well, because I did get caught up in the emotionalness of it, because you can't help it, because there's a 5-year-old sitting with his mother hoping and praying to get into the school, and then they don't get in.
Right.
But then I ran into someone on the street whose mother's really into it, and he couldn't stop screaming about how much he hated that movie.
Yeah. Well, was that me?
No.
All right.
Name drop Friday.
Yeah, go. Oh, was it, who was it? Matt Damon?
Yes, it was.
There you go. Isabel Gillies running into Matt Damon. Well, Matt Damon is a hero for people who care about this issue.
Yeah, well, he really let it rip about that movie, and I agree with him. But, you know, so I'm sorry I don't really have a movie for you. I got a little bit distracted.
That's
they
okay.
didn't have the ones on Instant Queue that I wanted, which makes me kind of upset about Instant Queue.
And, hey, and, do you want to just vaguely tease that you and I may be doing a side project?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, should we just put a little light?
We just did it. I just did that. You and I may be doing a little side project podcast once a week.
Dun, 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 dun.
Maybe. We'll see. All right, Isabel, always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank
even
you,
if
Sam.
You have disappointed everybody
me.
Without a by screwing
Believe
over.
Believe me, I'm sorry. I tried, and you know, really go out and maybe go to a morning show. It's only $7 a rock of ages. And okay, all right, bye.
We'll talk to you later. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jeff Smith, Occupy Wall Street. I think he has just come out of court, and we'll hear what he has to say for himself. Scofflaw! All right, we'll be right back after this. All right, we are back on the phone. Jeff Smith, part of the Occupy Wall Street media team, just coming back from court, I guess. And I should also say Jeff has got a new Twitter handle, Jeff5Myth. What is it?
You said it right, but you should, you know, spell out.
Okay, it's Jeff, and then the numeral 5, and then...
M-I-T-H.
Yeah.
Because when you say myth, people might think M-Y-T-H.
Yeah, you should think about that, Jeff. Switching it again. Jeff, so what's going on? What are these trials for? They've been going on for 4 or 5 days now. Who's on trial? What's going on?
What this stems from is from the December 17th action, which was an attempt to reoccupy a space called Duarte Square, which is at Canal and 6th Avenue. And this is basically a vacant lot that's owned by Trinity Church. And so the idea was to basically, after the eviction from Zuccotti Park, was to try and set up a new encampment and to petition Trinity Church to let Occupy Wall Street use this space to that effect.
Now, who owns more real estate in New York City than Trinity Church? Is there anybody? I know Stephen Green is a SL Green is a big holder with a several billion dollar market capitalization. Trump owns a lot of real estate. Who else?
Well, you know, I think Trinity Wall Street is literally the third largest landholder in the entire city and by far the largest landowner in the lower Manhattan. And most of that land was actually granted going all the way back to a land grant from Queen Anne in 1705. And actually, you know, Trinity Church was on the side opposite the colonies and the United States at that point. But so, yes, it's a huge real estate corporation. And the trial has really been interesting in terms of the balance between what is ostensibly a church and what still operates as a church, and also this huge real estate company.
Do they have to pay? Do they have to pay real estate taxes on that?
They do not. Specifically, there was testimony in court about Duarte Square. They don't pay any taxes on that space. And as far as I know, they're able to maintain this privileged status because they are a church and at the same time run this hugely profitable real estate corporation.
Yeah, I'd like to do that. I just have to get some real estate first. So what else has come out in court in the over the course of this trial?
So over the course of this week, the prosecution put on their case. It was mostly based around the fact that this is an enclosed area. And so as opposed to a lot of the other direct actions or arrests that have happened where it was sort of vague as to whether you were in public spaces and whether you're allowed to be there, this one was a little bit more specifically an attempt to sort of flout the law as a way to sort of play chicken with Trinity and force them into doing something that was, you know, not just charitable, but actually supported economic justice. And so what Occupy Wall Street did actually was bring in a lot of clergy. And so there was Reverend Ellick, who is from Judson Church, Reverend Mertz, who is a priest in Brooklyn. And then the most notable is George Packard, who is a decorated war hero and is basically a bishop of the Episcopal Church, but was basically the main priest or religious figure for the federal government for a long time, which included the military, prisons, you know, schools, that sort of thing. So this is a really prominent, high-profile religious person that was at the forefront of this action. And so he literally was the first person to go over the fence and to sort of say, I'm willing to, you know, set up an encampment here and try and push Trinity Church to do something that is, you know, what they say is in line with what a church is supposed to do. And so it was unfortunate that I think back in December, the optics of this action were a little blurry to a lot of people. They didn't really understand why is Trinity Church the enemy here, what happened to Wall Street. And so I think what we're seeing now in the behavior of Trinity Church and their willingness to prosecute this case to the fullest extent, and it's required actually a, you know, general counsel from Trinity to come in and testify. This is not something that the DA would have been able to make a case without Trinity's help. And it really appears as if they're trying to actually put people in jail for the first time. And the charges these defendants are facing has a maximum sentence of 90 days in jail. And a lot of people feel like there's a great likelihood that they may get that and go spend 3 months in Rikers.
How many defendants are they?
There are a total of 8 that are sitting in court now. There was a 9th defendant who was a photojournalist and whose charges were dismissed right at the beginning of the trial. So right now there are 8 defendants. 2 of them are clergy, and the others are mostly longtime occupiers. One other notable defendant, his name is Jack Boyle, who's been with the movement for a number of months, who is HIV positive and has been engaged in both a hunger strike and an AIDS medication strike in protest of this prosecution. So the stakes are clearly high for a lot of people, but I think mainly this case is most important because it really feels like this is where the city and the DA's office has decided to really focus a lot of resources and really try and make this one stick. So many of the other cases that have been going through the court system have all been dismissed, and they've, you know, largely been arrests on pretty much specious charges. But this one feels like it's the one they feel like they can actually make stick, and so they're going to do that. And so it really, I think, comes down to the judge. One of the peculiarities of this, and I guess this is part of our judicial system now, is that when you're not facing a crime that has a punishment of when you're facing a crime with a punishment of 6 months or less, you do not have the right to a jury trial. And in New York State, all those cases, these misdemeanor trials, have a bench trial only, which means that the judge acts as both the jury and the judge, and so you will be making all the final decisions. And this is the same judge that has basically been proceeding over all the Occupy cases since about February. And so it definitely seems like he's made, in many other decisions, an attempt to sort of set an example of people and to send people to Rikers even for a day or two when they couldn't make bail. So I think there's definitely a worry that he's going to try and make an example of some of these people.
And from the perspective of the movement, what is the value of this? Is to expose sort of this problem of a such a huge real estate holder in New York, essentially not, I mean, obviously they're not contributing to the well-being of the city from the perspective of providing tax revenue. This is obviously a problem. What else are are those people who are on trial hoping to expose, at least if not directly, but metaphorically?
Well, I think, you know, the big dichotomy or the big focus that the clergy that were on the Occupy side tried to point out is that, you know, churches are very much in the business of charity, which means that they'll happily, you know, dole out services in limited ways. But when it comes to true economic justice, when it comes to actually empowering people to make changes and really change the city and society as a whole, that they're really lacking. And Trinity has made such a big deal to try and point out how great they've been to Occupy. And it really strikes me as, you know, when you think of sort of super rich people, I think of like Bill Gates somehow claiming that he's doing philanthropy and, you know, he's actually benefiting society, when in actuality you see that essentially these things are just different forms of corporation and they exact the same kind of privileges that, you know, banks and other so-called evil corporations do, and there's really no difference. And so when it can happen to a church, when a church can turn into just a powerful corporate entity, you realize that, you know, the same thing happens to our schools, can happen to hospitals and our medical system. It's really a tearing away of all of the sort of public goods of our society, and I think that's always been an overarching theme for Occupy Wall Street. But the optics of this one is purely, is this church really going to penalize protesters, you know, activists that are just trying to better our society and fight for, you know, the oppressed and that sort of thing, and the optics of that against a church saying, you know, no, we're going to send you to jail because you trespassed on our vacant lot is pretty astounding. And so, you know, I think those are the issues that we're looking at. But I think overall, it's about, you know, the idea that Zuccotti Park was a super powerful symbol. And the idea that if a church or really any other corporation wanted to really use its mass wealth to help this movement, they could easily set up another space like that, that the city wouldn't be able to sweep away, and that you could actually start to see this movement, you know, take off again in a real way with some, you know, corporate or money backing. And so I think that's what's always been disturbing about even the so-called, you know, benevolent billionaires that have come in and wanted to be a plug-in and be a part of this movement. Everything's always been about, well, we want to give you certain funds, but only to do it the way we want you to do it. And to actually empower you to sort of create your own movement and just fund it, we're not interested in that. And it definitely feels like that's Trinity's position as well.
Right. We need to have some measure of control over where this thing goes, because our interests aren't sometimes aligned with those that the Occupy movement may be fighting against.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, that it's a big part of what religious life is today, I think, is that in many ways the sort of radical or left-leaning church has been marginalized, and they saw Occupy Wall Street as a real way to not only energize that aspect of the church, but really to draw young people back into church and, you know, Christianity, at least, in this country. And so, you know, I think all those things were conflating around Occupy Wall Street. And, you know, as early on, people pointed out that if you're going to think of Christianity as the, you know, the doctrines of Jesus and what Jesus was about, he certainly probably would have been at Zuccotti Park and supported everything that's happening here. And so the fact that Trinity is on the complete opposite side of that that ideology is pretty stunning.
When do you anticipate, is Monday now when we anticipate a verdict?
Yeah, the trial is now, this judge is looking to go on vacation soon, so he's trying to get this trial done as soon as possible. It should wrap on Monday. The last witness that's going to be called by the defense is actually Rector Cooper, who is the rector of Trinity Church, and who has really acted as the CEO of Trinity. It's really an odd relationship where you see the head of what is essentially the real estate company also the head of the church, and he actually gave himself the title of CEO, Chief Executive Officer, in addition to rector. So, you know, the idea that he can't actually make the decision or that he's powerless in that position, I think is totally false. And so we're going to see him put on by the defense, and that will probably be some of the more dramatic testimony. And then there'll be concluding arguments, and then the judge gets to make his decision as well as sentencing recommendations. And so I don't know if that will happen all on Monday or whether maybe we'll come back the next week, but he's looking to go on vacation, so I think we're going to get a decision on this early next week.
All right. Well, we'll follow up with you on this next week and sort of the other goings on, but appreciate your filling us in. And, folks, you can follow Jeff at Jeff, J-E-F-F, the numeral 5, and then the letters M-I-F, M-I-T-H. Sorry, as if it was Jeff Smith, but you replaced the S with a 5.
There you go.
I knew there was an easier way to do this. Thanks, buddy. I appreciate the call.
Okay. Take care, then. Bye.
All right, folks. That is our... He's laughing at my inability to...
I forgot about the letter...
the letter... It's hard enough when you mix those letters in the... And the numerals for me, it's that much more difficult. Folks, you can support this program by becoming a member. We need your membership to continue the program. I know I say this all the time. One day you could wake up, it's just not there. It would be a drag, wouldn't it? It'd be a drag for me. I'd feel bad about it. As I wind my way through the different internet, I'm not even going to go into that. Just any of the BS that I encounter in this industry. I mean, this is a job for me. It's one that I love to do. Some days it's harder than others. It's a lot of work. And I certainly am always on the lookout for other revenue sources. But there ain't much out there as far as I can tell. Not for somebody who's apparently... so strident. That's the thing I hear quite a bit. You really insist on being so strident? Like, well, I don't know what to tell you. I don't feel like I'm being strident. Other than in pursuing the facts. And making a sound analysis of those facts. And welcoming arguments as to the soundness of those facts. And by the point we get into that conversation, when I'm talking to someone like that, I can see their eyes glaze over. And what they really want to ask me is, am I willing to do any type of entertainment reporting as well? Sorry. So the long and short of it, please, if you can become a member at majority.fm, much appreciated. Of course, you can support this program by buying your Amazon junk through our Amazon link at majority.fm/support-the-show. You can find that link at the header of the website, majority.fm. We got merch. We're always looking for an iTunes review. Don't cost you nothing. Why not? JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate, organic if you want it. 10% discount code, coupon code, majority. We're going to take a break. We're going to go long today.
All right, sounds good to me.
I'll be taking your IMs in the better half of the program, which won't end up being a half. At Majority FM, you can give me a call, 646-257-3920. See you on Monday.